The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from teenvogue.com. Our first article today, Harvard Renaming. Students help change the names of buildings named for slave owners. And this article was written by Sidney Cobb. Dormitories are a fixture of collegiate life. The sticky floors contain traces of weekend revelries. The thin walls hold the gossip and gab of burgeoning groups of friends. The marred furniture bears traces of all the students that came before. These quintessential symbols of dorm life come together to form a semblance of home for the many students who are far from home. For some students at Harvard, though, the dorms do not fully feel like home. Emblazoned on some of the college's junior and senior dorms, called houses, are names that fall foreign on most ears, like John Winthrop and Increase Mather. However, they are lionized figures at Harvard, credited with helping to build and bolster the institution. These men and their efforts, funded primarily through their dealings with the transatlantic slave trade, are enshrined through their eponymous houses. In 2020, as institutions across the United States grappled with a legacy of white supremacy, Harvard was not spared. Students and other Harvard affiliates began to call for the university to examine its relationship with slavery and racial oppression. In response, the administration released a 132-page report in April 2022 outlining the university's ties to slavery along with reparative goals to redress the relationship. Shortly thereafter, the university introduced a denaming process to give students the opportunity to submit requests for university buildings to be stripped of their controversial names. The Generational African American Students Association, or GAASA, at Harvard, in conjunction with another student group, the Natives at Harvard College, submitted their 41-page request to dename Winthrop House on March 1st after combing through archives, staging teach-ins, and laboring for dozens of hours. I spoke with three students leading the change, Clive Lawrence, Kirsten Hash, and Ashley Dawn, about the report's findings, the implications of denaming, and how Harvard is reacting to their efforts. This conversation has been condensed and lightly edited for clarity. Teen Vogue, TV. To assemble the report, you all dug through archives and other texts to find information about the Winthrop family. What surprising things did you find? Clive Lawrence, CL. I'd read about John Winthrop. This is a figure that I learned about in history class as the benevolent founder of Massachusetts Bay Colony, who had this famous quote about founding a city on a hill. But then I learned about the context behind that quote and what his purpose was in establishing this colony, which was clearly to establish this European religious colony that dominated the indigenous communities that had already lived here. One of the most shocking things that we found was that Winthrop wanted to profit directly from the sale of human bodies. He helped write the first laws in North America to legally sanction slavery, which led directly to race-based hereditary chattel slavery in the colonies. This system, slavery, would exist in Massachusetts for almost 150 years until 1783. Winthrop's youngest son, Samuel, had 64 enslaved people and dozens of acres of land in the West Indies by the time he died. There were five generations of Winthrops that owned enslaved people. John Winthrop's oldest son, John Jr., was the governor of the Connecticut colony, and he enslaved several Native Americans, including a Native American woman, to be possessed and enjoyed by him. That's how it was written in his correspondences, so we can assume this woman was literally enslaved for his pleasure. This is one of the earliest examples of systemic and generational racism that would later become the United States profiting off the trade and exchange of human bodies for literally a century and a half. Even to this day, you can see how their legacy really wasn't impacted in a negative way. They have cities named after them. They have quotes about them that are very positive and, most obviously, they have a house at Harvard that is named after their family. TV. How did you all decide that denaming should be an effort taken on by GAASA? Kirsten Hash, KH. Harvard had sent out an email, just one email, actually, it's so funny, that said to submit your denaming request, and we will be accepting requests for denaming a building or place if the person that it is named after has morally abhorrent views or actions that would be considered morally abhorrent today or at the time. Administrators later told us you also had to identify the harm that it's causing to students and how it has impeded Harvard's ability to realize its values to create an inclusive environment. I remember seeing that email and I was like, well, I definitely want to find a way that I can engage with it, and then maybe the organization, GAASA, or collective can engage. I talked to our board members, and we were talking throughout the summer and into the fall about how we wanted to go about this. For some context, in April 2022, Harvard released the Legacy of Slavery report, which detailed the centuries-long history of their wealth building and how so much of this was tied to the transatlantic slave trade and slavery in the Caribbean and in the American South. We were coming off the momentum around that report and the general sentiment in the generational African American community, in the Black community, and in the Indigenous community that change needs to be had. Harvard needs to be held accountable for this abhorrent history, and that starts with rethinking, as an institution, who we're glorifying and the values that we're glorifying when we glorify these colonial leaders. TV. Can you walk me through what this experience has been like thus far? Ashley Dawn, AD. When I joined the effort, I immediately began working with the outreach department, which involves writing the petition and specifically educating people about the research that we had compiled. It was a lot of social media outreach, talking to people in person, distributing the petition, and hanging up posters and signs. It ultimately culminated in a demonstration that we organized in Winthrop Dining Hall. Clive, Madison Webb, and other students spoke at the front of Winthrop Dining Hall, going through the history of Winthrop, his role in the colonization of America, his role in legalizing slavery in the United States, as well as their experiences as Black students at Harvard, and more specifically, Black students in Winthrop. From there, we submitted the report to Harvard and asked them to dename, and now it's kind of just a waiting game for that to come back. TV. How has the larger Harvard community reacted to this effort? KH. A lot of people supported us. We had 500 signatures on the petition, and so many people attended the meetings, the teach-in in Winthrop Dining Hall, and reshared our posts on social media. But there were a few people that, for whatever reason, were either loudly indifferent or just resistant. I remember the night before we submitted the report, Clive and I were sending it over our email lists for Adams House. Some people replied to the whole email list, so everybody sees it, cracking jokes and being like, "Nobody cares," and that was really hurtful. TV. What would you say to those who are still on the fence about renaming? What is your pitch to those people? CL. Denaming is not erasing history. It is a specific process of contextualization and acknowledgement. It's a way for us to specifically reckon with the worst parts of our history without erasing it. I would say to other Harvard students who are skeptical, to really think about the ways that they interact with their environment and our environment as a whole and as a community, and how that affects Black and Indigenous students who have to face those realities every single day. Our intention with this project is to highlight history, not to erase history. AD. I would say that, for us, Denaming Winthrop is important not only because they were integral in slavery in the colonies and in the genocide of the Massachusetts indigenous people, but also because it's a first step for Harvard to take action in accordance with their Legacy of Slavery report. KH. We have to reckon with the foundations of America. The truth is that you can't disentangle America's founding, these colonial layers, from the original sin that created this country, indigenous genocide and the chattel slavery of African people. The descendants of those communities feel that when we walk the campus, as we see the colonial statues, and as we hear the names of people who enslaved our ancestors and led to the slaughter of our ancestors, that's the pain that you carry with you, and that pain is generational. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Celebrity Nation. New book tracks how celebrity worship took over in the United States. And this article was written by Landon Jones. Like many of us, I used to think that celebrity culture was an amusing diversion. Sometimes intriguing, often superficial, but not harmful. But that was before. As a founding editor of People magazine in 1974, I watched the celebrity state morph into a vast, profit-generating enterprise we can think of as the celebrity industrial complex. When I started writing for People, the other journalists in the Time Life building saw it as a déclassé distraction from the important issue-raising they were doing for the nation every week. But by October 1975, People was selling 1 million copies a week on newsstands, and by 1980, the weekly circulation was 2.5 million copies. When John Lennon died, the issue with his photo on the cover sold 2.6 million copies. We had conclusively legitimized a new genre, celebrity journalism, a name that once sounded like a contradiction in terms. No one was smart enough to know we didn't know what we were doing. The editor, Dick Stolle, said to me. At its heart, though, People was merchandising an illusion. We told the public we were writing about extraordinary people, but in reality, we began portraying celebrities as ordinary people. We were stripping away the mystery and mystique. Their private lives were on full display in the now mandatory home takes, in which photographers peeked behind the curtain and revealed the subject relaxing at home, off guard with their dogs, their partners, and their messy kitchens. There were no extraordinary people in this world. Everyone was recognizably ordinary. The stars were just like us. That, of course, was an illusion, too, a construct made by and for the media. Magazines like People were its initiators and, at first, its beneficiaries, but it spread beyond anyone's control. Today, there is no single model of celebrity. Thanks to the centrifugal forces of the internet and social media, celebrities are created overnight on TikTok and YouTube and reinforced by marketers and media. Now, an unruly democracy of celebrities crowds the public imagination. Anyone can become a celebrity with enough patience and enough followers. Yet, the damage is everywhere. Celebrity worship has become a disorienting force, hurting not only celebrities, but the nation as a whole. This isn't to say you can't be obsessed with your favorite musician and also organize around issues that matter to you. But it's where fandom tips into obsession that the risks become more clear. Here, drawing on my book, Celebrity Nation, How America Evolved into a Culture of Fans and Followers, are 5 ways that celebrity worship hurts us all. 1. Celebrity worship is a weapon of mass destruction. When we wonder why American politics has become so divided and disarrayed, all we have to do is turn on the television or check our smartphone and watch the celebrities parade by. They are commanding our attention. Meanwhile, the once carefully policed borderlines between public and private, ordinary and famous, famous and notorious, celebrities and heroes, have weakened or all but disappeared in recent years. As a candidate, Donald Trump mastered not just the messaging of celebrity, but its mechanics, too. He used TV and Twitter not only to grow and sustain his visibility, but also to position himself as the one politician who engaged his supporters directly, unmediated by the political elite. In the absence of experience and conventional qualifications, however, he was required to work endlessly to keep reminding people he was a totally big celebrity, since his fame was the primary measure of his merit. Do you wonder who the three most searched people were on Google in 2022? Answer: Johnny Depp, Will Smith, and Amber Heard. Here's betting on Gwyneth Paltrow and her court case this year. 2. The celebrity worship machinery especially disadvantages women and minorities. The first person to become world famous was Alexander the Great. Why? Because his was the first mortal face to be placed on a coin. Thanks to new technologies, men then dominated the ranks of the famous for centuries. It took the new visual media of posters and photography to enable entertainers like Sarah Bernhardt, Jenny Lind, and Annie Oakley to become widely known. In the 20th century, after the arrival of Hollywood, black women were hit particularly hard by racial disparities. Musical performers like Marian Anderson and Josephine Baker faced humiliating setbacks early in their careers. Today, the entertainers most at risk of erasure are still people of color. Just ask the come-up's Sophia Wilson. 3. Celebrity worship is especially bad for kids. The desire for fame starts early. From our youngest ages, people crave it. In Britain, in 2016, the organizers of National Children's Day asked children under 10 years old to reveal their Christmas wish. The desire to be famous or being a celebrity emerged at the top of the list, followed by good looks and being rich. The desire of individuals to acquire fame and celebrity is carried by generations, especially among children and pre-adolescents. According to one study, fame is the biggest goal in life for children in the U.S. ages 10 to 12. In a 2017 survey of 1,000 British children, the most popular choice for a future career was YouTuber. According to a 2005 survey done by the Washington Post and Harvard University, 31% of American teenagers thought they would become famous one day. A 2012 study in the journal Psychology and Marketing found that intense personal worship of celebrities most affects female adolescents who acquire a poor body image. The hunger for fame is not about we. In other words, fame, which rewards individuals, has grown in influence, while those values promoting community strength, equality, and democracy have diminished. 4. Celebrity worship promotes narcissism. Everyone who seeks fame risks suffering from the very real diagnosis of what is known as acquired situational narcissism, or ASN. No, there is not a pill for that. ASN is a diagnosed condition in which those in high positions of power, such as movie stars, politicians, and professional athletes, develop narcissistic traits as a result of their fame. ASN is a multifaceted personality trait that combines grandiosity, attention-seeking, and unrealistically inflated self-view, a need for that self-view to be continuously reinforced, and a general lack of regard for others. Narcissism can lead people to seek out fame, but ASN develops after achieving success, sometimes intensifying narcissistic tendencies that were already present. ASN is fed by attention from others. Individuals with ASN tend to be high-profile celebrities, so the attention they receive is necessarily more intense and constantly reinforced by their employees, the media, and of course by their fans and followers. There is essentially an unspoken Faustian bargain between the celebrities and the media. If the celebrities cooperate with the media, and the more they feed the media's needs, the bigger they become, they hold on to their fame and fortune, but at the cost of their individuality, their privacy, even their independence. And the more famous they become, the more vulnerable they become. What this amounts to is that our addiction to fame has become a key component of the American dream, but one that betrays us. F. Scott Fitzgerald previewed it in his judgment about the wealthy Buchanans in The Great Gatsby. They were careless people, Tom and Daisy. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness or whatever it was that kept them together and let other people clean up the mess they had made. 5. Celebrity worship promotes materialism and compulsive buying. Consider the new generation of brand influencers. The scale is astonishing. Kim Kardashian alone has more than 350 million followers on Instagram. What is less well known is the impact on the millions of her followers. Many of them have what researchers call problematic engagement with social media influencers. A 2022 study by three Australian scholars estimated the size of the influencer market at $13.8 billion in the U.S. alone. Then they looked at what is termed the dark side of social media influencing. They specifically drew on psychological attachment theory to examine the ways that followers can become attached to and obsessed with brand influencers paid to promote their buying choices. They studied two types of attachments, parasocial relationships and sense of belonging, both of which are key in social media influencing. A parasocial relationship refers to followers' perception of their one-sided relationship with an influencer, and a sense of belonging describes the feeling of being an integral part of the influencer's community. The study showed that when followers develop attachments both to influencers, a parasocial relationship, and their community, a sense of belonging, it can lead to problematic engagement. Risks include negative consequences such as followers' anxiety and depression, eating disorders, and spending well beyond one's means. If we compare ourselves to the fantasy lives they see exhibited by brand influencers on social media, it is not surprising that we look into the mirror and find ourselves feeling alone together. Celebrity is ultimately at the core of a cash-generating ecosystem that empowers social media, nightlife, entertainment, fashion, publishing, television, and much more. If celebrities can negotiate this thicket carefully and gain the self-awareness to use their platforms for good, unmediated by intense media coverage, there is hope. And our next article from TeenVogue.com. University of Chicago is first to settle in financial aid price-fixing lawsuit. And this article was written by Lexi McManaman. Last week, the University of Chicago became the first of 17 schools accused in a class-action lawsuit of overcharging students by billions to agree to settle some claims in court. The settlement applies only to UChicago, not to any of the other universities involved in the suit. The full list of schools includes Brown, Yale, Columbia, Georgetown, MIT, the University of Pennsylvania, Cornell, Northwestern, California Institute of Technology, Dartmouth, Emory, Duke, Notre Dame, Rice, Johns Hopkins, and Vanderbilt. The lawsuit, filed in January 2022 in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois on behalf of five students, accused the schools of having considered prospective students' financial needs in weighing whether to offer admission, disfavoring students who need aid, per Reuters. The suit accuses the schools of having participated in a price-fixing cartel that is designed to reduce or eliminate financial aid as a locus of competition, and that in fact has artificially inflated the net price of attendance for students receiving financial aid. The universities, in three separate filings, one from all the schools, one from Yale, and one from UChicago, Emory, and Johns Hopkins, attempted to have the suit dismissed, claiming exemption from antitrust law, which would typically bar such coordination between the schools, because they are, in name, need-blind institutions, meant to disregard one's financial circumstances when applying. This is based on the Improving America's Schools Act of 1994, which created the 568 exemption that allowed schools to collaborate on financial aid formulas only as long as they are need-blind. That exemption expired last September. The schools involved were part of what was called the 568 Presidents Group. U.S. District Judge Matthew Kennelly, who will later review the terms of the UChicago settlement, disagreed with the school's assessment. Last August, he refused the accused institution's attempt to dismiss the case. As reported by the Daily Pennsylvanian, the student paper for accused university UPenn, his opinion found there indeed was evidence of schools favoring the children of wealthy past or potential donors, violating the need-blind directive. Defendant universities never complied with a congressional mandate that they be need-blind regarding all students and all families in admitting students, Robert D. Gilbert, one of the attorneys representing the plaintiffs, told student paper The Georgetown Voice last fall. Instead, for decades they exploited the exemption to favor wealthy applicants and families and to disfavor applicants from middle-class and working-class families. The suit claims that 9 of the schools, Columbia, Dartmouth, Duke, Georgetown, MIT, Northwestern, Notre Dame, UPenn, and Vanderbilt, sometimes chose wealthier students when taking applicants' financial need into consideration, with at least some doing the same for waitlisted candidates. In an update to the filing in June 2022, plaintiffs calculated that if the universities just put 2% of their funds toward financial aid, 9 of the 17 schools could cover tuition for students on financial aid, and that the cost of a degree at the other 8 schools would fall by an average of $12,000 per year. Attorneys say some 200,000 former students could be eligible to join the class action. They argue that by dissolving this coordinated cartel, students would receive more competitive financial aid packages from universities, thereby making college more financially accessible for students for whom tuition is a barrier. Privileging the wealthy and disadvantaging the financially needy are inextricably linked, reads the lawsuit in part. They are two sides of the same coin. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.